from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll get a preview of FoodCon at the Harrison Center.
Yum. I'll chat with Music for All's Scott McCormick.
And I'll take a look at the Indianapolis Art and Antique Show. Plus, there's our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Food for Thought is an examination and celebration of the ways food helps to define Indiana's culture, considering food in the context of history, law, politics, science, the arts, religion, ethnicity, and our place in the world. The Indiana Humanities Council has organized this two-year-long program, which kicks off with FoodCon at the Harrison Center for the Arts on Friday, March 5th from 6 to 10 p.m. Sharon Gamble, grilled... Kristen Foos-Wells, Communications Director for the Indiana Humanities Council, and Joanna Taft, Executive Director of the Harrison Center, for the details.
People who listen regularly know that I love food, so this topic is right up my alley. But I have to ask, where did the idea of Food for Thought come from?
Well, Food for Thought was the brainchild of our president and CEO, Kara Amstutz, who is a foodie as well. And just, you know, we wanted to take the humanities to a broader level and thought that like you, everyone loves food, and that food was a really great way to engage people.
And it's a big project. It has so many moving parts and pieces with literature, poetry, art competitions, visual art. I'm picturing a brainstorming session.
Sure.
Where
we've had many brainstorming sessions.
Yeah. How do we extend this across the community?
Yeah. Well, we've had great feedback from everyone that we get in touch with, and so many people want to be a part of that, and that's why it's so great to partner with people like the Harrison Center. But, yeah, we've just collaborated with a ton of different partner organizations, and we're just really excited. This is kind of the unofficial kickoff and just ready to really get rolling and get started with Food for Thought.
Cool. And FoodCon... which has been described as, to foodies, what Gen Con is for gamers. Joanna, those are your words. You're nodding in recognition.
Yes.
This is kind of cool because you are right across the street from the Humanities Council, and so it's kind of a natural opportunity to partner. Have you guys ever partnered on anything before?
We have. We've actually been slowly building a great partnership where the Harrison Center will put on an exhibit during First Friday, and the Humanities Council has joined the First Friday team, and so they'll have a wonderful pre-party and lecture, and then people can come across the street to the Harrison Center for Art. And so we've had some of our artists exhibit at the Humanities Council and speak about their work, and then they've also shown local artists and had other guests as well. So it's been a wonderful, enriching partnership for both of us.
We need a name for the Delaware Street corridor there. So it's not an official cultural district, but I'm sure you guys are cooking something.
It will be someday.
Good girl. So the obvious place to start is visual art that deals with food in some way, but not just in the literal sense. I'm assuming that when we come to FoodCon, we'll see paintings, photographs of actual food, a bowl of pasta, an eggplant, but extending that idea as well, right?
I think that you'll be surprised as you see how poetry and films and hands-on activities and exhibitions all make this into an unconventional food convention. So when you go into the gymnasium of the Harrison Center, there will be over 37 local food organizations represented. So we'll have farmers markets and CSAs. And
what's a CSA?
A community supported agricultural cooperative.
Okay.
And so you can buy a share of a farm and have a box of vegetables delivered to your house every week or at a local pickup spot, that type of thing. And then businesses, local businesses, for instance, some of them are very familiar to you, like Goose the Market, but then we have, you know, the B3 Bakery and farm fresh delivery and natural born juicers. So there's some that are very familiar and some that are brand new to many people in the community. And then organizations like Slow Food Indy and then something like just community groups that start. How do you start a neighborhood supper club? We'll have a table that will teach you how to do that.
Wow.
And so seasoned supper club members will actually say, hey, we have a supper club.
You didn't just say seasoned, did you?
Seasoned, yeah. And spicy.
There are all kinds of opportunities for things like that.
I'm sure.
Sorry. But they can they can tell you what the rules are. You know, how do you decide who's in the group once the group is formed?
And
how
do you
often
keep
you meet?
Going?
How do you keep it going?
Yeah.
How do you build community in your neighborhood?
Oh, this is so cool, and I see why Spirit in Place is a partner in this as well, because the opportunities for partnership, once you start that ball rolling, I mean, you think about food as a spiritual experience.
Yes.
People who used to watch public television back in the day when Jeff Smith, the frugal gourmet, was around, that was his that was his theme, was that sharing, preparing and sharing food for people you love is a very spiritual thing. So lots of dimensions. Joanna, you have a group of cultural entrepreneurs that you've been working with. Tell us about that program.
Right. We receive funding from a number of groups, including our first national funder, Starbucks Foundation.
Congratulations.
With their Shared Planet Youth Initiative, yes. And it's very exciting for us to, as we attempt to build culture in the city, we decided that we wanted to include the very talented high school and college students that like to hang out at the Harrison Center. And so rather than viewing them as cheap labor, we're really investing in them, and we are teaching them how to become cultural entrepreneurs. And a cultural entrepreneur is someone who sees a need in the community, and they take a risk. It's scary. They invest energy. They leverage resources because we don't have any money, and then they network to build culture. And so this FoodCon, this unconventional convention is being planned. The team leader is a college student, and she has a group of four or five, maybe actually six now, high school students that are planning FoodCon. And this is being 100% led by our cultural entrepreneurs, and it will be a fabulous event and great resume-worthy experience for their future.
How are the adults on your staff responding?
Oh, well, they love it because we get more done, and our office is so, our office is fun anyway.
Sure.
But every day is an inspiration. They all bring ideas to the table. In fact, maybe Kristen wants to talk about one of the ideas, the Vienna vegetable.
Yes.
Maybe she can talk about
Vienna vegetable. We're very excited. Something that will be at FoodCon is a take on the Vienna Vegetable Orchestra, and the Heron Jazz Band, I believe, the Heron High School Jazz Band, will be doing their own version where they play music with actual vegetables. So they go out and they buy the vegetables, and then they turn them into instruments.
Carve
and then play
them,
with
dry
them. Yeah,
them,
exactly.
Tune them.
There are so many ways. Yeah.
They've been experimenting. They put down drop cloths in the gym, and they peel, and they core, and they do different things and experiment with different sounds. And so you'll actually be able to hear the real Vienna Vegetable Orchestra during Spirit in Place, but this is a way for us to play with vegetables and for our audience to also make their own vegetable instrument.
And to call your mom and say, you told me I couldn't play with my food. Kristen, what's the most unusual, I'm sure as word has started to get out about Food for Thought, people have approached you with all sorts of proposals to be partners. What are some of the more unusual?
Gosh, you're going to put me on the spot here. I really can't pull any unusual ones out, but we just have some really great projects out there, everything from the Naturally Victorian exhibit over at the Morris Butler House to some community book clubs who just want to do, maybe read three or four books about food and then have some discussions about them. And I'm trying to think of some other ones, some other really great ones that we have. But through our program, we're also going to be doing this traveling exhibit, so we'll be taking it around to communities, and I'm sure we're just going to get more interest as we go along.
So the idea is to create something here that could be replicated around
the
state.
Exactly. That, with FoodCon, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Is there anything like this in another community? I'm sure you've researched either before going down this road.
We don't
or
think so. Yes. We kind of think it's the first of its kind.
We hope so. We hope there'll be more.
Yes.
And what do you want people who come to FoodCon to go away with? If you did an exit interview, what would you want people to say to you that they had learned or done or thought about differently?
I think we want people to be changed. I think we want them to understand how important the local food movement is and how food and sustainability builds community. And so we actually will have a little partnership with In Shape Indiana, where there'll be a table where maybe a trading post of types where you exchange a thought for food. So it's food for thought, right?
Uh-huh.
You can go up to the table and write something down about how this year your thought is to start a progressive dinner in your neighborhood. And with that thought, you will get an apple or a banana as a reward. And so we are hoping that people begin to think about what they can do and how they can engage with the local food movement. And I think that even though there are all these wonderful groups, I don't think they all know each other.
Sure.
And I think by getting them all in the same room together, I think we're going to be amazed at what happens.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we're going to start a movement. There'll be more of a movement. And we'll see wonderful things happen in the commitment to local food and sustainability.
We should probably, before we go any further in this conversation, define, and it may be a slightly different definition from each of you, what do you mean by local food movement? How do you think of it?
Well, it does mean different things to different people, and there are people who are certified organic locally, and there are people that are proudly uncertified organic and don't like the political label.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that we know that there are local farmers, there are local urban farmers. We would like to support the Indiana businesses, the independent businesses that are growing sustainable food here in Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
And we want people to start gardens in their backyard. One of my cultural entrepreneur interns, Audrey Brinker, started the Tomato Project, and is a wonderful program where she grows tomato plants and she gives them out for adoption.
Aww.
And people take a tomato plant home, and then they harvest the tomato plants and they donate them to a soup kitchen. Audrey will be at FoodCon, and she'll be, you can actually plant a tomato seed made out of an org and making little origami pots,
uh-huh.
you know, with the seed and the soil,
uh-huh.
and you can take that home. And so I think that there's a wide range of ways that you can connect with this. And the food movement has every personality. You have people that don't want to eat meat. You have people that don't want to eat dairy. But I think that everyone is welcome to this table at the Harrison Center,
mm.
and it's about building community and sharing and learning from each other.
And from the Humanities Council point, we are a neutral convener. So although we are a partner with FoodCon, we really try to not take a stance on any issue. So for us, local food means celebrating what's uniquely ours here in Indiana. You know, whether it's that Red Gold actually uses Indiana tomatoes, even though they're not what you might typically think of in the local food market, or that Indiana is known for, you know, what we say the five P's, peppermint, popcorn, pies, persimmon, and pork. Just getting the word out about all those things that are uniquely ours here in Indiana.
Do you, either of you, have a personal commitment to local food? Do you grow vegetables? Do you
patronize
local?
The Humanities Council had a victory garden last year in our backyard, and we're going to have one again, an even larger one this year, so that was very exciting. And I have my own personal garden and try to eat local whenever I can.
I know, Joanna, because I've seen you out patronizing some vendors.
I travel a lot, and so I don't always make it to the Indy Winter Market, but when I'm in town, I love to be there.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite places. I also have a strange fascination with food reclamation.
And really?
Yeah.
Where did that start?
There are several food salvage stores in Indianapolis, mm-hmm. where you can actually buy organic food, and I'm a regular shopper at those places. And they're fun because you never know what you're going to find. And
it's a treasure hunt.
And so so I buy my brown rice and my organic bacon and my, you know, all kinds of, it's different every week, but it things that fall off a truck, things from railroad crashes, it's amazing.
Wow.
And so there, people find out about those surprises at FoodCon as well.
Sharon Gamble with Kristen Foos-Wells, Communications Director for the Indiana Humanities Council, and Joanna Taft, Executive Director of the Harrison Center. When you go to FoodCon, pay special attention to the exhibit called Farmers Market Society, a multimedia art, sociology, culinary, philanthropic extravaganza organized as a senior project by Butler University student Kristen Hess. For more information about Food for Thought, visit IndianaHumanities.org. Again, IndianaHumanities.org. And to learn more about the FoodCon, check out HarrisonCenter.org. HarrisonCenter.org. The FoodCon is on March 5th from 6 to 10 p.m. at the Harrison Center.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Indianapolis-based Music for All's operations include Bands of America and Orchestra America. Music for All is celebrating 35 years of presenting the nation's finest high school and middle school bands and ensembles with the Music for All National Festival presented by Yamaha, taking place from March 4th through the 6th at Clues Memorial Hall, as well as numerous other locations in town. Travis DiNicola spoke with Music for All's CEO, Scott McCormick, about the festival.
I am looking forward to hearing about this huge national 35th anniversary celebration of Music for All coming up in just a couple weeks. But before we jump to that, briefly, what is Music for All? Because it's actually sort of a new conglomeration of a bunch of really great organizations.
Yeah, I think most of the listeners would probably be most familiar with Bands of America. We relocated here to Indianapolis from Chicago in 2003. And then a couple of years ago, we went through a merger with an organization called the Music for All Foundation, which their primary bent at the time was doing research and advocacy about arts education and keeping arts and music education alive and well in our schools.
So, music for all the kids
absolutely.
In the schools.
Absolutely. So for us, as we started to branch out of the band world, in addition to doing orchestral things and other music programming, it was a great name change for us. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, it allowed us to embrace the totality of what needs to really be the focus of what's going on education-wise.
You know what? It's an interesting thing. I mean, lately, certainly, the not-for-profit world has been hit, as everyone else has, by the economy. And one thing that there was a lot of talk of for a while is, will you see a lot of not-for-profits merging organizations? And actually, in fact, there really haven't been a whole lot, but yours seems to be a really good example of essentially sort of two similar but different organizations that have merged well.
Yeah, actually, Music for All Foundation was based out of New Jersey when we merged with them. Mm-hmm. A smaller organization, but doing great work, doing major studies state by state with what access and equity kids had available to them. And the merger worked out well. Unfortunately, the person that was the principal of that organization left us a year ago and is still doing the research work, and I admire the work he's doing. We continue to promote what they're doing. But the merger worked out well. I mean, it was two like-minded nonprofits that mm-hmm. are benefiting what's going on in music education right now.
And primarily what people see is sort of the Bands of America, the junior high and high school, the contests and yep. and so on that bring together kids from all over the country. And there's a lot of huge events that are coming up. I guess let's go ahead and jump into that.
Yeah,
because
well,
this is such a big deal right now.
Our Music for All National Festival, which is really our spring focus, really what most people know us for is probably the marching band thing that happens in November at the stadium. And this festival really focuses on a non-competitive event, which showcases mm-hmm. excellence. So it started as a national concert band festival. We added orchestras and percussion ensembles to that. We just added a middle school national festival. One of the things that we believe in the next step is that with young kids, they're challenged so much with the opportunities that they have before them that getting them at a younger age in music and arts is critical. So right now there's great middle school programs all over the country and they have no place to showcase what they have. Mm-hmm. So adding this component to the festival coming up this next weekend was a great piece. We've got 8 middle schools coming in addition to the high school groups.
And again, I want to also point out that this is different from another great local organization that has a national reach, which is Drum Corps International. They work with kids who are essentially out of high school, yeah. Primarily college, and you know, sort of a different take, but I'm sure you know some of the kids move from one to the other.
Yeah, absolutely. DCI, we have a great sister relationship with. They're a strategic partner of ours, but it is high-end marching, mm-hmm. and these primarily are college music education performance majors that are there. There are some high school kids that do it at a high level, but it is the next step for those folks that want to do it beyond their high school years.
Sure. But so you're working with kids in schools, and obviously kids who are the beneficiaries of some really strong music programs, and that's an important thing. And let's actually talk about that for just a moment here, because, I mean, right now there's been a lot of talk in Indiana, but also across the entire country, about the difficulty of funding education the way we'd like to all see it fund. And unfortunately, as we know, one of the first things that at least people talk about cutting tends to be the arts.
Yeah, that is unfortunate. With No Child Left Behind, there was a strong push to make sure that arts and was a part of the core curriculum. And unfortunately, not everybody recognizes that. It was great that Arnie Duncan, our Secretary of Education, came out in August with his letter to the education community, making it clear that arts education was core curricular. So unfortunately, I think what happens all too often is the school board is faced with these cuts that they have to look at, and it's the easy thing to look at because they view it as extracurricular, when in fact, if it's in the day, it is a core curricular side of what we do, and at minimum, a co-curricular side mm-hmm. of what's going on in education. And I think the challenge that people miss is that the economic society we live in today is one of creativity and imagination, and where we're going to thrive as a nation is to get our kids to embrace that. Unfortunately, some of our testing mentality is based off of the industrial model that served us well for the time that it served mm-hmm. us, but it's a different model today.
It certainly is. And what's unfortunate is that for a lot of these kids, I know this is a general sweeping, statement, but these are good kids, who are working really hard to be in band or orchestra and to practice. And for many of them, if it wasn't for the opportunity that the school presents, then they might not be able to afford to have lessons or participate otherwise.
Yeah, it's not only that they're great kids, but it's that they are those that are excelling in the schools. And, they're scoring higher. This is evidenced. They're scoring higher on SAT tests. Of the students that participate in our programming, 92% of them are going on into college. And,
wow.
It's hard.
That's an amazing graduation rate.
It is hard to find those. And I'll take it a little local here. When we came to Indianapolis, one of our key components was to really focus on Indianapolis public schools and the music programs. We're surrounded around the county with some great programs, Lawrence and Avon and Carmel, and mm-hmm. the list goes on and on, Center Grove. But Indianapolis public schools challenged on a lot of fronts.
Yep.
But we've embraced those kids. We have scholarshiped many of them over the last 5 years. About 200 kids come to our summer symposium each summer, and we've tracked their graduation rates. And we read America's Promise that comes out and says we have the worst graduation rates of the 50 largest school districts in the country at 31% or whatever that is, and we've tracked these kids that have come through the music programs at IPS, and they're graduating at a rate of 78%, which is higher than the national average. So it's not only that these kids that are making great music are struggling, they are our best and brightest. And, when we start to pull those things that excite them in the school that differentiates, I think we're tending to go the wrong direction with education.
Well, one way to certainly celebrate these kids and their achievement is to come out for the National Festival. Now, I know a lot of this takes place at Clues, but you also have many other venues. I'll let you just sort of walk through what's going on in about a little over a week here.
Yeah, it is a complex event. We have concert bands and percussion ensembles. The concert bands will all perform at Clues Hall beginning on Thursday evening, March 4th. That starts at 6 p.m. Four groups will perform. They perform an hour-long concert, each of these high school groups. And we've got 31 ensembles that are coming from 12 states all over the country.
Wow.
As far as California and Arizona to the west, Florida and Georgia southeast, Virginia up on the East Coast. They're literally coming into town, about 2,500 young people from all over the country. So the festival concert bands perform at Clues. We have the middle school and percussion ensembles, the Sandy Feldstein National Percussion Percussion Festival, perform out at Warren Performing Arts Center, and that happens on Friday evening and Saturday morning. So those are the two main venues, and then the third venue is Hilbert. We have three national honor groups. We have an honor orchestra that will share a concert on Friday and Saturday evening with the symphony with a special start time at 7 p.m. So these kids who have auditioned from all over the country will come and open the symphony's concert at 7 p.m. on Friday and Saturday night, doing Mussorgsky's Pictures and an exhibition and Festive Overture, which will be a phenomenal performance in addition to the great work that the ISO will do that night.
That's pretty cool. So if you're going to the symphony on those nights, you get to hear the kids first.
Yep. Make sure you show up at 7, little earlier time than normal start for the symphony. But we've been doing this collaboration with the ISO for a number of years, and it has been a great partnership and a great opportunity to showcase these kids at a very high level. I remember sitting with the chairman of the board a couple of years ago as our orchestra, the Honor Orchestra, played their first couple of notes and he turned to me and said, "Wow."
Nice.
And, you know, that was enough said about the performance level of these kids. And then on Friday night, we have additionally a National Honor Jazz Ensemble that will perform at Clues. That concert's at 8:30.
I'm looking forward to checking that out.
Yeah, it'll be a great concert. Dr. Lou Fisher, who is the head of jazz studies over at Capital University and one of the co-founders of JEN, which is the Jazz Educators Network, which is sort of an outgrowth of what IAJE, the Jazz Educators International organization was. He co-founded that. And guest soloist will be Wayne Bergeron. And I don't know if everybody would be familiar with Wayne. He's a trumpet extraordinaire. He is the lead trumpet player with the Gordon Goodwin Big Fat Band, if people are familiar with that group.
Okay.
Here's an important piece, is that Sunday of this next week are the Academy Awards, and he turned down the gig of playing lead trumpet on the Academy Awards to come
to be here
to play
nice.
With us in Indianapolis. So.
Very cool. Now, some of these you do need a ticket for, but there's some free events too, right?
Yeah, all of the events out at the Warren Performing Arts Center, the middle school, and the percussion ensemble's performances are all free and open to the public. The rest of the events through Clues are Ticketmaster events, they range in price from $10 up, and the jazz concert's a $15 ticket, reserve seat ticket. So all of those are available at Ticketmaster or through the Clues box office.
Now, are there any, I know we've got some great talent from all over the country, but any local talent being featured here?
You know, this year there are local students that are involved in all of the honor ensembles, but this year, for the first time, we do not have a local band or orchestra or percussion ensemble in the festival. We often have groups that are local that perform, but we have a number of folks that are in the honor ensembles that will be playing throughout the weekend.
Cool. And so this is a great opportunity for especially local kids who are musicians and their families to just go check out some great talent.
Yeah, it's an incredible family event. I mean, it first of all, you're going to be surprised at the level of the high school and these middle schools that are performing what they can do. And the honor ensembles are really, truly some of the finest high school kids I've ever heard. The concert band that'll be Saturday night at 8 o'clock at Clues is opening with John Adams, A Short Ride on a Fast Machine, it's incredible music. They're going to do selections from Bernstein's Mass. It's going to be an incredible concert on Saturday night as well.
And, of course, the whole schedule is available at musicforall.org because there is a lot going on.
Absolutely.
Definitely want to check that out. I just want to mention, I just got a press release. We have a new board member that was just announced.
Yeah.
Doug Polari?
Okay.
Doug
is with IBM Global Services. I think he's involved with another arts organization here in town. He's a father of a number of alumni students that have been involved with us up from Carmel High School. So Doug brings a wealth of technology experience to us and,
that's great.
And a great addition to our board.
And great to have that local connection as well. One thing that I want to do, we're going to take a listen to a piece that you brought with you. We'll start listening to that now. Tell me about the piece that we're going to give a listen to.
The piece is called Concerto for Soprano Sax and Wind Ensemble, and it was written by John Mackey. And the guest soloist is Tim McAllister, who is a saxophone teacher out at Arizona State University. Last year's conductor of the group was Gary Hill, who is the director of Wind Ensemble out at Arizona State. And Tim, for those of you who may have seen Dudamel's opening performance with the L.A. Phil this past fall, they did a special, and Tim was the saxophone soloist with the L.A. Phil. So just an outstanding performer, and we were honored to have him as a soloist. And this is the last movement from Concerto for Soprano Sax and Wind Orchestra.
Scott, I want to ask you, anything else you want to let us know that's going on? Because I know you've got a lot of other events and things coming up.
Well, the next piece of our programming ties to our Summer Symposium, which is a national event held over at Illinois State University. I touched on it with our connection with IPS. We continue to raise dollars to hopefully scholarship more and more students over to that. The track record of those kids being involved in their music programs is obviously paying off from the graduation rates. So that event will focus about 1,400 students from all over the country and 225 educators who come for professional development. It's our 35th anniversary this year, so when the fall comes around and our National Marching Band Championship back at Lucas Oil, I'm sure we'll have a great blowout then, but that's down the road, and for now, we really want to focus and raise up these kids that are doing a great job this next weekend here in town.
Travis DiNicola with Music for All's CEO Scott McCormick. The Music for All National Festival, presented by Yamaha, takes place from March 4th through the 6th at Clues Memorial Hall, as well as numerous other locations in town. For more information, visit musicforall.org, musicforall.org.
Love about this time of year, Sharon?
What is it?
Pitchers and catchers have reported for spring training.
Woohoo!
That's right.
This being the last weekend in February, in the late winter, a young man's thoughts and sometimes a young woman's thoughts turn to thoughts of baseball.
That's right.
And I actually have something baseball appropriate on today's calendar that we call
What'll We Do? Really?
I'm going to throw out the first ball here.
Nice.
On March 14th, the free showing of a movie at Central Library's Clues Auditorium at 2 o'clock is 8 Men Out, filmed in Indianapolis and Evansville.
Yeah.
Baseball film. It's time to start thinking about all of that snow going away and coming to us.
That's right. I know everyone's thoughts are turning to good weather and baseball and things like that. Something else you want to turn your thoughts to, speaking of the Library Foundation is again accepting nominations for the Eugene Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards. Last year was the first year for it. Now it's the second year, 2010.
That was fast.
I know. It's already here. And you can actually nominate an author from now through March 26th. And if you go to the IMCPL website, you can get all the information. They'll be looking for national and regional and up-and-coming awards or authors to receive those awards. Very cool program.
That is totally cool. And again, speaking of the library, you have just a couple of days left to take in the Meet the Artist
exhibit. That's right, great exhibit.
Which is throughout the main floor of the new Central Library in both the old library and the atrium.
There you go. Hey, speaking of art.
What? Another segue? Could it be?
Another segue. Well, as sad as I was to see the G.C. Lucas Gallery close down, at least they're doing something cool with the space right now, and that is IDOTA, the Indianapolis Downtown Artists and Dealer Association, is going to have their first ever first-in-line art exhibition and sale as part of the First Friday events on Friday, March 5th, and it will be held at 884 Mass Avenue, which is the former site of the G.C. Lucas Gallery, and it's an exhibition and sale of all works by local artists, original works, and all the works will be priced at $100 and available for purchase on first-time, first-served basis, and there will be a lot of both up-and-coming and some very well-established artists who will be shown at this, but I can't tell you who they are. You have to go and check it out.
And it's called First in Line?
First in Line, and it starts at 6 o'clock at 884 Mass Ave on the 5th.
You know, when you said that, being an inline skater, I pictured art.
No, it means you have to get in line first.
Art on parallel wheels.
There you go.
Don't wear your skates there. It might be dangerous. Hey, I don't know how to segue to this, except that musical drama is an art form. There we go. That's it.
Nice.
This coming Monday, the 1st at 7:30, one of the free U of I faculty concert recitals. It's called Musical Dramas in English, and it features soprano Kathleen Hacker, soprano Elizabeth Hogberg, mezzo-soprano Mitzi Westra, countertenor Stephen Rickards, tenor Michael Sylvester, tenor Christopher Fries, bass baritone Roy Samuelson, and pianist Amy Eggleston. And you're going to hear selections from Abraham and Isaac and Peter Grimes, also some more contemporary music by Dominic Argento, and much, much more. All free Monday, 7:30, Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Center.
There you go. Hey, not only can you go check out the world premiere of the political thriller Sunlight at the Phoenix Theater, but on March 5th and 17th, you can also talk about it, because there will be post-play discussions following the performances on both March 5th and on the 17th. It's part of a rolling world premiere of the play written by Char White, and it was the Edgerton Foundation New American Play Award winner for 2009. And again, it is a political thriller dealing with topics of torture and the suspension of habeas corpus. So it should be very interesting. The discussion should be even more interesting. Definitely go check that out at the Phoenix.
Travis, I know you like traditional Indianapolis
classical places, classic, like Chatterbox. Mm-hmm. And have you ever been to Behringer's, which is near Garfield Park?
You know, I have not. Tell me more.
It's a great old tavern. Great old tavern with lots and lots of atmosphere. Good bar food, great burgers. And they have instituted...
Sounds better already.
I know. Every Thursday at 8 o'clock, there is a comedy contest. No cover charge. $3 Guinness pints, and some of the area's most talented comics compete for a $500 grand prize each month. So whether you're a comedy consumer or maybe you're a comedian yourself, you might want to go check out Behringer's Comedy Night, Thursdays at 8 p.m.
Very cool. And perhaps you've noticed that there's a large contingent of Shakespearean scholars under the age of 18 in town. Maybe you haven't. I don't know.
I have noticed that.
Well, it's part of the Young Indiana Thespians All the World's a Stage. Actually, on the 28th of February, 14 young Shakespeare enthusiasts from all around the state are participating in the Indiana 23rd Annual Shakespeare Competition for High School Students. And it is going on at Clues Auditorium at 2 p.m. Really cool competition. And worth checking out to see some of these great new young talents.
Excellent. The visual artist, photographer David Bartley, has a show that you might have heard about on this very station, this very program, called Look Up and Look Around. It's nature photography, and it is on view at the Holiday Park Nature Center through March 15th, so just a couple more weeks to take that in.
And last thing I've got is just a reminder about the Concert to Benefit the World Food Program that is being performed by the Indianapolis Children's Choir and taking place on Sunday, March 7th at the Pike Performing Arts Center, 2 p.m. Definitely worth checking out.
Speaking of student thespians, I'm going to go back to that for a minute. Now is your opportunity to take in the Cherry Orchard, the great Chekhov play, as mounted and performed by Butler University's Theater Department. It's the last performance is this coming Sunday at 2 o'clock in the Studio Theater at Lilly Hall at Butler University.
Check it out before that tree falls down. Okay, we'll be back next week with more of
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Artful objects from the 1800s through the 1960s, beautifully displayed by 100 top antique dealers, art galleries, and regional artists, are featured in the 23rd Annual Indianapolis Art and Antique Show. The event takes place at the Indiana State Fairgrounds from March 12th through the 14th, and proceeds are directed to advancements in healthcare through Methodist Hospital Task Corps. The Arts and Antiques Show features a special luncheon with a renowned designer. This year, the speaker is interior designer Suzanne Kasler, whose design business has been based in Atlanta for the last 15 years, but who called Indianapolis home earlier in her life. After receiving her design degree from the University of Cincinnati, she worked for Roland Design before starting her namesake firm here. Suzanne's designs have been photographed by many of the leading design publications, including Elle Decor, Architectural Digest, Traditional Home, Southern Accents, Veranda, and House Beautiful. Suzanne's new book, Inspired Interiors, has just been published. Sharon Gamble designed this interview so we could get a few professional tips.
When did you first notice that design mattered? Do you remember, was there something that happened when you were a child where you just suddenly said, hey, I feel better if my room is a certain way, or I love this color?
Well, I think I have always just appreciated, like I always call it the small things, and I always just noticed that I appreciated a lot of things when I was small. However, I grew up in the military, and my dad, who is Colonel James Kasler, and he is well known in the Indianapolis community, he was a fighter pilot. And we moved my whole life. And what was interesting is I've repeated before that I did not know I wanted to be a designer when I was young. You know, it wasn't one of the things that I really did recognize. So it was just interesting that that part of it did not evolve until a good friend of mine who was going to architecture school had a big influence on my kind of following and kind of looking into interior design and interior architecture. Until I was really in high school, and we had come back to Indianapolis when my dad went to Vietnam, and we ended up there from, my parents are from Indianapolis, and then he was a prisoner of war Vietnam for 7 years.
Oh, my gosh.
And so we stayed in Indianapolis, and that's how I ended up really going to high school and growing up there.
Was in moving around a lot, of course, you don't know this when you're a child because that's your normal. You think everybody does that probably. But in retrospect, do you think that there was something helpful in maybe taking cherished objects with you as you moved?
Yes, I think that kind of creating a sense of place and doing that with a lot of change has ended up being a huge benefit in my career because, as you know, our business involves so many components and parts that I kind of know how to have it all in, you know, kind of like in your mind and then get it all moved in somewhere and then get everything kind of in its place.
Mm-hmm. You know, looking at some of the articles that have talked about your designs, and more importantly, looking at the photographs that go with, there's a great sense of calm in the interiors that you've designed. Where does that come from, and is that something you consciously do?
Well, I a lot of people comment on kind of this kind of fresh feeling that I try to create, and I think that I have this foundation of appreciation for architecture and space,
mm-hmm.
and I don't like over-decorating, and so at the same time, I love things to have a personality or kind of either reflect the person's, you know, house or place, or, and a lot of times it can be determined by where the location is. So I think that it's interesting how, you know, that has kind of evolved, I think, from my love of architecture and space. So I kind of want that to be showing. And then I kind of start layering. But I always have said that editing is one of the biggest parts of our business.
Knowing what to leave out or take out.
Yes.
If you were working with a client who already is in a home and maybe wants to work on, a living room, would you start by literally pulling things out so that you could see the bones of the room then?
Well, what I do is when I kind of start with someone that's in an existing home, I actually go through and inventory a lot of their rooms because I might make exchanges. I might move things into different areas of the house after we get done looking at everything. But I really do like to look at the room, and sometimes I'll want to add some architectural detail like a bookcase, or I'll want us to paint and change the whole feeling of the room, you know, to create that envelope of strengthening whatever we have going on. I have added, you know, taken a room and opened it into another room or closed up a closet in a room.
Hmm.
And just, I do really look at that first. And then I start what I call kind of layering. But I inventory, you know, what their all their pieces of furniture in their collections and then come up with kind of a master plan.
In the process of that inventorying, does that give you a chance also to get a sense of that person's style? Because a lot of us, we know we have a style, but we maybe don't have a vocabulary to describe it. So is that how you kind of get a sense for somebody's aesthetic?
Yes. I really think that probably one of my strengths in design is, and I think I can do a lot of different looks, I really like it to feel like they're home when we're done. And I really work hard to understand and appreciate, you know, kind of, even if the client doesn't always know, I can help them translate kind of a lot of that into three dimension.
What's the quirkiest or most unusual object somebody has brought to you or shown you and said, I'm inspired by this, can we build a room around this or a look around this?
Well, there's, you know, I guess when you think of Designers, in a funny way, were always looking for something kind of quirky or unusual to give personality to a room. So I don't know that we ever think of hardly anything that's kind of so unusual that we can't work it in. But I did have a client recently. You know, we were doing actually they were building a house, and we did a beautiful, really beautiful library. And the her husband had this huge, you know, a marlin fish.
Oh.
But he had it painted by the, well, by the, I think the people that, I don't even know the name, I could probably find out, that almost, like, do those, all those really fancy motorcycles.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Or I don't know if it was them, but it had that kind of whole, so she said, I don't know what, we're going to do with this. And I said, you know what, it's going to be great. And we literally finished everything and then hung it right over desk. And it just, you know, so what designers really actually embrace and like, you know, we really like the quirky and the individual, because then immediately the client does get their sense of personality created in.
Sure, it's their room and not,
yes,
not someone,
yes,
else's.
And so we, yeah, you know, if you create the right space and architectural background, then really I have found, you know, so many things work. One thing I do, though, a lot of my clients will have collections. I have another client that has a beautiful collection of Majelica, and we kind of put it all together. I try to encourage collections. If I can put them all in a grouping, and I've done that with my own Eiffel Tower collections. I collect them everywhere, and I collect them in the airport and when I travel, whenever I see them. But I put them all on this one big table, and you can see in my book I show a picture of, you know, they're all together. And
what
so
a
that
trip.
Is one of the things that I try to do, because everyone, you know, I even encourage my clients that have collections to kind of embrace them.
Yeah, if you're go for the excess rather than put them all
but
out.
But they really work best if we put them together. They don't look, you know, they really become something kind of more significant.
Sure, absolutely. How did you go from working with other people's pieces to designing furniture? And I know you're working on a lighting collection and fabric collections. How did you decide to make that leap?
Well, I started, you know, years ago going to the Paris flea market or even just the fabulous antique shops here in Atlanta. And I would buy pieces, a lot of them kind of maybe, you know, unique for my own self and my own home, and people wanted them.
Ah.
And then I would say, well, if I could just find that kind of chair or that scale of loveseat. And then also as a designer, a lot of times even with your upholstery, you're all designing your own things with the upholstery. Or you're working out the details. I, you know, love the grosgrain ribbon nail head detail, and I was always working that out with the upholsterer and working out the flat flange detail. So what kind of evolved was it would be great for me to be able to have, you know, a whole collection. And that's kind of how it started. And being a designer, we love to shop and find things. And one of the great things about it is that I continue to be able to do that and then really have my viewpoint translated into, you know, the many different collections. And once you do a furniture collection, then you want the lighting to go with it, or not exactly match it, but it kind of has a certain feel.
Sure.
And then I just did this rug collection for Safavia, and then the fabric line for Lee Jofa is going to come out next spring.
Wow. How often do you redesign your own living spaces?
Well,
or do you have time? I don't know how you would
have
time.
Yeah, what I did, my husband and I moved 2 years ago to a new house. We actually renovated an old house and added on. And I will tell you, as a designer, always hard because you don't always have time for your own projects.
The shoemaker's children go without shoes.
But I will say that it is a great canvas. And we had lived in our other house, which is actually in the book, our other house. And we lived there 15 years, and so we moved to another older neighborhood in Buckhead in Atlanta. And I just, you know, wanted a new canvas to work from, and it's been very exciting. But what's interesting is my collections of things, because I, you know, really have loved a lot of the things I've added to over the years. It's been great to see how they kind of have worked into the new house.
Absolutely. What a treat.
And so really, once
so
I get
years.
The house kind of done, which could take a few years.
There might be a new book.
Yes. We're in the works on that. My book has done, it went into a third printing, and so they were excited for me. And, yeah, I think that could evolve. But the nice thing is when I finish the house, you know, it's always, you know, a lot of my collections, but I don't really change it a lot once I get when I get it kind of done.
You get the feeling that you want or the look that you want. And
yeah, I kind of, and then, you know, I get to do all of my expressions with all of my clients, you know, all the different things. That if, you know, since, and then once I get my own home kind of settled, but it takes a while. It will take a while for this one to be really, really finished.
To be fair, I should really ask this next question of your husband, but he's not here and you are. Does he have a room in the home that's just his? Or is his taste incorporated with yours?
You know, he has a fabulous library that is his, and he does laugh, though, because he has been great and so supportive, but he has come home before, and there might be pieces I bring home and decide not to keep, and then he'll come home, and they'll be gone. So as I kind of, you know, have evolved with the houses, he's been very great about letting me kind of have it unfold, but he does have his own, you know, great library space.
That seems only fair.
An office.
Yeah.
Yes.
Sharon Gamble with interior designer Suzanne Kasler. You can hear her speak on Friday, March 12th at 11 a.m. at the Indianapolis Art and Antique Show. You can purchase Suzanne's inspired interiors and have her sign it before and after the luncheon. Tickets for the luncheon include admission to the show, and luncheon tickets should be purchased in advance. More information and an order form can be found at MethodistHealthFoundation.org. Again, MethodistHealthFoundation.org, and then go to Antique Show.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4, when I get the scoop on the IUPUI literary magazine Genesis.
I'll find out about the New Century String Quartet's 10th anniversary.
And I'll get a preview of the Indie Convergence Dance Festival. And, of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.